This is Dave Vellante, and welcome to the November 30th Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting, where peers discuss challenging problems. And today we have a very interesting topic. The topic is RAID dead? And we're broadcasting live, and I apologize for those who couldn't hear it before because of the chimes. We're on justin.tv. It's justin.tv/Wikibon. So if you go there, be aware that we're on a 5-second delay. But there is a capability to chat, so there's a chat window. So please feel free to communicate to us that way. Stu and I will be monitoring that as well. I'm here with John MacArthur, our Wikibon colleague. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
And we're also on the line with Chris Gladwin. Chris is the founder and CEO of CleverSafe out of outside of Chicago. And despite his CEO title, Chris is actually an alpha geek out of MIT and wrote the original algorithms for the CleverSafe dispersal technology. And welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
So, as I say, we're broadcasting live from the Wikibon offices. Is RAID dead is the topic today. And here's the basic premise, and then we'll dig into this a little further. So as drive capacities increase, the probability of a drive failure starts to approach the size of a disk drive. And so failures actually become not only statistically possible, they become increasingly probable. Add to that drive rebuild times, which are elongating, and your possibility of a failure during rebuild increases. And then in addition, as you enter encryption and compression and data deduplication into the equation, it complicates things even further. So that's the discussion that we're going to have today. We have a rogue line on, so I got to mute everybody. What we'll do is we're going to talk to Chris a little bit for the next 10 or 15 minutes, or let's say 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up and have a broader discussion. So Chris, again, welcome. Thanks for coming on the call. Thanks for bringing this topic to our attention. But can you explain a little bit further and actually quantify the problem in a little bit more detail, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Dave, and appreciate you guys taking the time. I think this is definitely an important topic. To quantify this a little bit more, I was just looking at some data from 1991 at a Maxtor 7040A 40 megabyte hard drive. And that drive took 37 seconds to read the whole platter on the drive. Now, that's a pretty small drive. The problem is, even though since 1991, the speed of the drives have about tripled, the size of drives have about increased by 100,000 times. So the result is the time that it takes to read or write a whole drive worth of data has gone up considerably. And that means the time it takes to rebuild a failed drive in a RAID array has gone up considerably. And the bad news is it's an accelerating trend. So where it used to take, you know, seconds to rebuild a drive, now, you know, with a 2 terabyte drive, it takes about 8 hours, best case, to rebuild a drive. And it can take, you know, 36 hours is what we've heard some of our customers say, you know, in a real production environment. So the window of vulnerability for multiple simultaneous drive failures is accelerating. The other problem that's going on is the bit error rate, or the when you write and then you have an unrecoverable read error where you can't read back what was on the drive, is also approaching a point where it's becoming statistically a big problem. Bit error rates on drives run around every 10 to the 14 to 10 to the 15 bits. And for the longest time, you know, back in the days of 40 megabyte Maxtor hard drives, statistically that was just such a big number you didn't worry about it. Well, a terabyte is about 10 to the 13 bits. And, you know, 10 terabyte drives will be 10 to the 14 bits, meaning the size of the drive will equal the bit error rate of the drive. So every time you read or write a drive worth of data, a bit is wrong. And Dave, as you just mentioned, when you're using compression or deduplication and definitely encryption, you know, single bit loss is a huge problem. I mean, if it's encrypted and you lose a bit, pretty good chance you're not going to get any data back. And if it's highly, you know, if it's an efficient compression scheme, you know, the more efficient the scheme, the less tolerant it is to bit loss. So that's an accelerating problem. You know, the result is that the odds that you experience data loss as your data set grows, and everyone's data set grows, are increasing. and one of the real challenges is this is not a kind of a one-time phenomenon. It's really driven by inherent properties. Drive sizes are, the size of a drive is really driven by electronics, and that's pretty much proven by, if you take the drive sizes over the past 20 years and plot them, they basically follow Moore's law exactly, meaning drive sizes are doubling every 2 years, just like processor speeds are doubling every 2 years, because how many bits you can cram on a drive is really driven by the electronics. Unfortunately, the speed of the drive is really driven by physics. How fast is that platter spinning? How fast is the read-write head moving? And you can't just double physics every 2 years like you can with electronics. So, you know, like I said, that Maxtor drive from 1991, that was a 3,500 RPM drive, 40 megabytes. So drives are now about 10, you know, they spin about three times faster, but they're about 10,000 times or 100,000 times bigger. So that's not good from a speed point of view. So on a Moore's law adjusted basis, drives are thousands of times slower than they used to be, which means rebuild times are thousands of times longer than they used to be, and it's accelerating. You know, 10 years from now, 5 years from now, 3 years from now, the situation will be even worse. So where today you're in the you know, tens of hours to rebuild a drive, you know, you're soon going to be in months, you know, in terms of drive rebuild times, which causes a decreasing, an accelerating decrease in reliability. So that just gives you a little kind of quantification, you know, of the problem.
Yeah, thank you for that. So, you know, when we all read that RAID paper back in 1987, the Patterson-Gibson-Katz paper, you know, the case for redundant arrays of independent disks. It might have even been called inexpensive disks at the time.
Originally, yeah.
But, you know, we sort of all remember where we were. At least I remember where I was. Yeah. I was behind the walls at IDC. And we were astounded by that. I said, wow, this little light bulb went on. And then, you know, we saw all these RAID technologies come out. Of course, we saw the EMC symmetrics with RAID 1. And it really changed the industry. But so I wanted, Chris, to clarify, because when I tweeted this out before, as Ray did, I got a lot of great feedback from people. Thank you very much. And I'm at D. Vellante, by the way. If for whatever reason you can't get through in the line or the chat window is not working for you, I'll check Twitter. But what do we mean by RAID? Are we talking about parity-based RAID? Are you including mirroring in this discussion? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so there's kind of a marketing answer, and then there's a technical answer. I mean, technically, you know, when I think of RAID, I think about parity. I think about, you know, RAID 5, where you're using one-dimensional parity, where you can tolerate the loss of a single drive within an array, or RAID 6, where you're using two-dimensional parity, where you can tolerate up to two simultaneous losses in the array. That's what I think of when I think of, you know, RAID. And unfortunately, the math of parity ends at two dimensions. You can't have a third parity dimension. You basically at that point have to make a second copy. And that, as a solution, that can improve reliability, but it's a very expensive solution. And it's okay to make, you know, two or three copies. You know, it's expensive because it doubles or triples your capital, air conditioning, space, electricity. But, you know, to solve this problem by making an accelerating number of copies, meaning, okay, first you'll make two or three copies, then four or five, then nine or ten, you know, as a way of addressing these longer rebuild times, it's just not sustainable. And you can see the wall coming. You know, when you have, let's say, a petabyte of storage, you know, RAID 5 is already at the point where even if you make copies, you're at the point where your odds annually of data loss are in the 80% range. You know, on an 80% chance you're going to have data loss on an annual basis if you're using RAID 5 when you have a petabyte. RAID 6 extends that window, no doubt about it, and it's pretty good when you're using 1 terabyte drives, but, you know, starting with 2 terabyte drives, you know, RAID 6 starts to get into the realm where you have, you know, again with a 1,000 disk storage system, you have about a 5% annual chance of data loss, and then, you know, you go to 4 terabyte drives, 8 terabyte drives, you know, but at that point you're in a 40% annual data loss range, and then, you know, eventually you get to 100% chance as you move into larger drive sizes. So that's how far RAID goes, and then it kind of hits the wall.
And then, if I heard you correctly earlier, 10 terabyte drives is roughly the crossover point with the bit error rate, is that right? Or?
Yeah, when you get to 8 terabyte drives, you're in the you're it's not making a lot of sense. You know, even with two copies, you have a 40% annual chance of data loss with just a petabyte. And a petabyte sounds like, you know, I mean, sorry, 1,000 disks worth of storage. That's not that big of a system. And then you grow beyond there, and now you're, you know, 80%, then 100% chance of annual data loss. So that's really kind of where the crossover occurs, in the kind of 4 to 8 terabyte range is where RAID 6 stops making sense. It happened with RAID 5, you know, back in the, you know, 500 gig kind of range.
So when I, as I say, when I tweeted this out a couple of weeks ago, I got a lot of great feedback from people, and I want to get into sort of what the technology industry is doing about this problem. You know, there's the Zyotech-like bricks with ICE. There's
Yep.
wide striping and mirroring, like an XIV. I've, you know, a RAIF, redundant arrays of independent file systems. So I want to, and obviously dispersal. The Gluster file system and file systems like that. So a lot of people were very much aware of this issue, and it's been the discussion point that we've talked about at some detail in the Wikibon community. But I wanted to open it up at this point to folks, just to see if there were any comments or questions on the initial premise, you know, that essentially we're approaching the crossover point. And I would add to that, Klaus Mikkelsen's SNW stat. He said that it's going to take I think a month or two to rebuild the 30 terabyte drive. And of course, we don't have 30 terabyte drives today, but presumably we will someday. Right?
We will have.
We will someday. So now, so I had to mute everybody because we had that rogue line, and I've been unmuting people selectively. And so, if you want to talk, you can star six. Should unmute yourself, and if you can't, if that doesn't work for whatever reason, just tweet me at @dvellante. But I'd like to open it up, and I know Rob Pegler is on the line as well. And Rob, you and I had a great discussion on Twitter about this. I don't know if Chris Evans is on. We heard from him, and I know Alex from NetApp is on. And it was just some really good discussion going on. So I'd like to just sort of take a pause here and allow the community to weigh in. So anybody out there have any comments?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Aviad.
Hi, if you wouldn't mind just introducing yourself, first name, last name is ideal, or just first name if you're not comfortable giving your last name.
Sure. So my name is Aviad Ofer. I'm actually from IBM. We guys met. You guys came to our facility. Just one interesting comment about the bit rate, the error bit rate, which is essentially how often when you're going to perform a read against a drive, you are actually going to get a response back that the drive cannot do a read. I think this is important when we, with the drive getting bigger, like was mentioned. But what's more important here is when you have a failed drive in the system and you're actually rebuilding, and you only have one copy or less copies than the normal of the data that you need, and you encounter at that time the error, the bit error, then you pretty much don't have the data. Now,
right.
If technologies at the time of the rebuild actually read less from the drive, the probability of encountering that problem, is less. So technologies in the future, when rebuilding data, will have to not read the entire disk or a large portion of it, so they will not encounter that bit error rate.
Yeah, excellent point. And this is Chris again. If I can add one other thing to that, there also is the scenario when you're rebuilding a drive that is completely lost. And if you're, you know, let's say a, you know, 5+2 kind of RAID configuration, in order to rebuild that drive, you have to not read a drive worth of data, but five drives worth of data. So it makes your odds of a bit error, you know, five times greater. So, you know, that's another consideration in this kind of calculation, that you know, of reliability.
Okay, other comments just before we move on to solutions here? Go ahead.
There was a follow-up.
Oh, was there a follow-up?
Yeah, I have a comment. This is, can you hear me okay?
Yes, sure can.
This is Brett Cooper. I'm also with IBM. But I think the premise here is a good premise. I think if you look, you know, take it up a couple levels, which is the application that leverages the storage for performance and reliability, The thing that RAID was always invented for was a question of reliability and being able to recover data in case of a hardware error or software error affecting a drive. The issue that's never been overcome that I see from RAID technology is performance. Because the thing that's actually doing the recovery is the RAID controller, RAID processor, or software. So if you bump it up to the level of the application, which is really what I think the market is paying for here, which is performance. The performance is what suffers. The market's paying for two things. They want performance and reliability. So RAID technologies have provided that reliability, but at the price of performance during recovery. And your point is well taken that, you know, if it takes N number of days, weeks, or months to do recovery, that's one thing happening, but what we're not really discussing here is the performance implication of that recovery, because there's only usually one or two RAID controllers that are doing that recovery, and during that process, there's the, you know, the FIFO of access to those datagrams that's occurring. So there's got to be something that gives here in that process, and it's usually down to the RAID controller that can only handle, you know, the task of recovering data and serving that data. So where is the, you know, where is the performance that I pay for when this RAID recovery is going on?
So that's right. Great. We've got it. And Chris Evans tweeted me before this call that he felt like the drives need to provide multiple I/O channels, some for data and repair and recovery, and maybe do RAID at the block level, not the disk level. So that's one possibility. There may be others from a standards base. But other comments, and we'll come back to that performance issue.
This is John MacArthur. I would just say that I'd be interested in a poll of customers that as to whether or not they buy technology based upon RAID rebuild times or as opposed to application performance when there are no problems. But I don't think it enters the, I think at least too often it doesn't enter the conversation at all.
Should it?
I think it should, absolutely.
So speaking of polls, there's a poll on Greg Schultz's blog.
It's
because it's sort of really tangential to what you just said, but it's a poll about is RAID dead. So good for Greg for putting that up.
Okay.
I don't know if he pivoted off of this call, but it's I think Stu probably has up now, but it's the storage I/O blog. And I don't know. A few people have weighed in that, you know, not dead yet, I guess.
Mostly dead.
To steal a line from Monty Python, but. I know some other people on the call, I know Steve Foskett's on, and he said he had a run. You know, if you guys want to chime in, Steve in particular, please do before you have to go. Again, star six. If you're not being heard, get you in.
It's Josh Kircher.
Hi, Josh. Josh Hi. Kircher, everybody, from Josh Kircher Associates. What's your angle on this, Josh?
Two things. Is at the end of the next decade, 2020, the SAS drives 2.5 inch will be 12 terabytes, and 3.5 inch will be 50 terabytes. Today, already 2 terabytes to recover full terabyte recovery of SATA disk can take a week on subsystem. So what Klaus said is true, or even I would say optimistic. Now, you have several things which can be done today. What in Hitachi disk, for example, what you have preemptive copy when the error exceeding the threshold, which this is normally the disk, or many cases the disk didn't die at once. It's showing temporary errors. And in this case, the Hitachi is copying the disk. Copy disk is fast. Recovery from RAID 5, you have to make to read all the disk and to sort the data and etc. So it's much, much faster.
Yep.
Now, I personally, the first thing is what is helping now is that three companies announced the 2.5-inch disks with reduced capacity, which, again, reduced capacity is making the recovery faster. However, I don't think that RAID 6 will be used more than 10 years. And in something around 4 or 5 years, you will have a common use of triple parity RAID or the cluster RAID.
Okay. So smaller disks, cluster RAID, they address the problem, Chris, in your opinion, or are they just sort of a Band-Aid?
Well, I guess you get into semantics a little bit, and I'm, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the market reacts, but clearly, you know, if you look at, you know, kind of previous to RAID, you know, there was no parity then, you know, the most common kind of RAID was single dimension parity for reliability, then, you know, RAID 6 with two dimensional parity. Clearly the long-term answer is multidimensional parity or some kind of M of N coding, advanced coding techniques where you can tolerate multiple simultaneous failures beyond just two, you know, without having to make a copy. You know, at that point you get into, there's a, you know, so setting aside the marketing names for a second, there's a lot of different, you know, it's all based on Reed-Solomon math, also known as forward error correction, also known as erasure coding. And then when you add security to it, it's usually called information dispersal. So those kind of advanced coding techniques can solve these problems. And we've seen this in other industries. If you look at what DVDs, for example, do, you know, DVDs, I think they're like 56 of 64 kind of encoding on the disk, so they can tolerate, you know, eight simultaneous bit failures, you know, if the disk is scratched. And that's just built right into the way that DVDs work. You know, if you look at the way that mobile digital telephony works, which is pretty much all telephony these days, you know, they're absolutely using all kinds of forward error correction. You know, the bit loss they deal with is way, way higher than 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15. You know, yet they're able to communicate digitally because they're using forward error correction. So the techniques exist to solve these kinds of problems. And it'll be interesting to see what it's called from a marketing point of view. Is it going to be called RAID, even, you know, when it's like a 10 of 16 or a 56 of 64? You know, that's to be determined. But that's so, clearly, you know, where we think things are going to go.
So a couple comments from the Justin channel. Alex Tangent, at Alex Tangent, for those of you who follow him on Twitter. Couple of points that I'll read off just to get people's thoughts here, and also Dennis Martin and Steve Foskett have weighed in. So RAID at the block level is scrubbing. This is Alex. The IBM statement on reading less equals fewer errors. He calls into question it's the amount of data read that's the key. Mirroring is grade 10, for example. Grade is where we're going. Groups of RAID treated as parity. And then let me just read back the comments from Dennis at the Martech. We've tested some of the disk arrays in our lab that have multiple RAID controllers that at least address the recover speed to an extent. And then Steve Foskett said it's all about semantics, which is just what Chris just said, right? RAID isn't dead as a term, but parity has had its day.
Yep.
Some thoughts from the community on Justin there.
Yeah, so that would be my thesis, is that parity only goes to two dimensions, and then you got to do something different. You got to move to Reed-Solomon, and you know, the trade-off is, you know, you can have M of N, you can have any number of simultaneous failure tolerance, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 12, you know, and you can statistically model out a system where even with you know, petabytes or exabytes of storage, with bit error rates of 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15, with, you know, month-long rebuild times, you can still build a system where you have, you know, your desired level of reliability, you know, 6 nines, 12 nines, you know, whatever you want it to be. And the way you achieve that is through advanced coding techniques like information dispersal, which is all based on Reed-Solomon. That solves the problem. The trade-off is you're doing a lot more math. You know, parity is, you know, it's one instruction of math. It's pretty quick. So, but when you're doing Reed-Solomon, you're doing a bunch of linear algebra, which is a lot more math. So then you have to look at the long-term trends. And the good news is math is Moore's law. So the speed and, you know, of math and the cost of math, you know, gets twice as good every 2 years. So the trade-off is right, particularly when you're talking about hard drives where, you know, from a performance point of view, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you got to look at how fast you can push or pull bits on and off a disk on a drive, and can the math keep up? And clearly it can. You know, 10 years ago, if you were to do these kind of advanced coding techniques with an array of drives, it would appear slower. But now, given the speed of drives and the speed of processing, you can do this kind of coding technique and have it all happen in real time. You know, it's something that we do at CleverSafe. That's what our products do. It's also something that EMC has introduced, you know, something that NEC has introduced. It's also used in, you know, lower end markets. Like I said, DVD and mobile telephony does absolutely do this kind of math with very inexpensive parts all in real time. So that's definitely a way to solve these problems.
So real time.
By the way, DataDirect today is using Reed Salomon error correction code.
Yeah, a lot of people are.
Yeah. So Foskett says indeed Reed Salomon is capable of protecting into the foreseeable future, and it'll probably be called RAID 6 while it does it.
Well, RAID 6, I mean, to me, has the connotation of two-dimensional parity. I know a lot of some people are using Reed Solomon to calculate the second parity bit in a RAID 6 array for performance reasons. Mm-hmm. But you know, to really take advantage of Reed Solomon, if you're really saying, look, I got to store a petabyte of data or 10 petabytes of data, which today is a lot of data, tomorrow is nothing. You know, I mean, it's going to be pretty typical. You know, there you're going to have to go beyond two-dimensional parity with making a lot of copies, and you know, you're going to be looking at probably something like six-dimensional parity, you know, where you have an array where you've got, you know, 16 drives or 16 servers, and you can tolerate the simultaneous failure of any six. That has not only reliability benefits, because you can now, you know, the odds of six simultaneous failure before the first one got rebuilt, even if it takes a month to rebuild the first one, you can build a system where that you can still have reliability even with month-long rebuild times. But you also get performance advantages in that you're now parallelizing your reads and writes across, you know, 10 or 20 disks at a time, where you're writing, let's say, 1/10 as much information to 10 times as many disks in parallel, so you can get performance improvements, and there's other, you know, kinds of advantages besides that. But when you get into multi-petabyte systems, you know, those are the kind of techniques that we think people are going to use. Whether or not it's called RAID, you know, that's to be determined, you know, from a marketing point of view. But on the inside, you know, to get into multi-petabyte, you've got to go beyond just parity.
Okay, so I wonder if we could bring in Rob Pegler. Rob, are you on?
Yes, Dave, good morning.
Good morning. I'd love to hear your perspective on this, Rob. We've been going on a back channel for the past few days, and give us your thoughts.
Well, I'll be glad to. First of all, thanks for hosting this call. There's some great discussion going on, and a lot of the points are just spot on. I've been enjoying listening to this. There's several points which I'd like to bring up, and first of all, I agree almost 100% with Chris and Alex and the other guys that are saying, you know, parity methods are now growing obsolete, and really the evolution of the drives, and more importantly, the type of drives that people are choosing is forcing us to that. We all know there's significant difference between, you know, serial ATA and non-serial ATA drives. One of them in particular is the use of DIF, or the data integrity field, which is a standard for SAS and fiber channel, but not for ATA. We've incorporated DIF and have actually found terrific results with that. The whole idea here is to prevent, you know, checksum and data corruption errors before they happen, and if they do, to notify and retry and to eliminate that source. I mean, there's several good papers out in the field, in particular, Garth Gibson at CMU and Bianca Schroeder at Toronto have written some very good done some very good research on this about not only latent sector errors, but checksum as well. Bit error rate is also discussed. So that's one thing, and I wish more arrays would incorporate the DIF technique. It is standard. It's out there to be used, and we've been using it now for over 2 years. But even beyond that, in a more general sense, you know, given where drives are going, we really need to do two things. The first thing is we need to reduce the fault domain for data. As you mentioned, Dave, you know, the classic Patterson, Gibson, and Katz, which is over 20 years old now, you know, the fault domain was a drive. We need to get the fault domain down to a head or even a portion of the data under a given head to reduce that. Now, if you do that for an 8-head drive, you've immediately reduced the fault domain by an order of 8, which allows you to do more simplistic and faster not only parity calculations, but the rebuild and recovery as well. After all, if the fault domain is ahead of a drive rather than a drive entire, you're only rebuilding inside the fault domain. And as was mentioned by a previous caller, copying is even better. But again, the general aspect, if you treat the disk drive as a system, and you really should, it's not just, you know, a commodity, a piece of spinning rust. The disk drives are little systems just by themselves. They have CPU, they have cache, they have memory, they have interconnect, they have an ability to communicate with the outside world and act in harmony. And the key to that is firmware. So there's a lot of good work being done, not only by my company, but some others in the field as well, to look at disk drives as holistic systems and write firmware that does things like reduce the fault domain, treat the drive as a grid of storage rather than just a linear array of blocks from zero to N. And the whole idea here is to preempt or prevent errors from occurring through, as Chris rightly mentioned, advanced coding techniques. But again, diving down to the firmware layer, that's where you can reduce the fault domain, and you also reduce the control domain, which again was mentioned before, the number of disks that a given controller, quote-unquote, is responsible for. That's gotten way out of proportion, in my opinion, especially in large arrays, especially with large ATA. And that's really a very, very large control domain, which, if you look at the science, is difficult to control when errors do occur. So if you reduce the control domain and have, for example, only 20 or 40 drives per controller, and Chris is exactly right, Moore's law comes into play, that's a good thing. You know, I can apply more controller horsepower to a given set of drives than in the past because I can leverage Moore's law on the CPU side, as opposed to the drive side, which is a finite thing. As Chris rightly said, the drives are not spinning any faster. There's only a certain amount of electronics you can put in there, especially with the 2.5. Now, we've been doing the 2.5s for almost 3 years now and are finding great favor with them. And I think the holistic idea of having smaller drives and more of them does have some merit as years go by. And again, the key to doing that is to reduce the fault domain and reduce the control domain. Use techniques like GIF. Do repair in place instead of driving, you know, rebuilding drives entire. You know, prevent errors given the inherent UER or bit error rate of a drive. Reducing the RAID group sizes is also important. I think Chris mentioned that. You know, getting out to a 14 plus 2 RAID group, I think, is asking for it in terms of rebuild corruption. But having a 4 plus 1 or a 4 plus 2, and especially if the control domain and the fault domain is a head level instead of a drive, maybe that will buy us some time at least, if not solve the problem entirely, given what GIF can do. And then, you know, last but not least, keeping the performance, you know, very high. I think that's a very good point that people overlook, but it's going to be looked at the, you know, the consumer level of enterprise arrays much more closely than it was in the past. I'm seeing some signs of people looking at that right now. Is it a strong buying criteria? Perhaps not, but it's going to grow in importance. So again, that's why reducing the fault domain down to a head is important. After all, why rebuild a whole drive if only a piece of data under one head is failing?
Yeah, okay, there's some comments on again from Alex on Justin. What's really good here is the idea of an unprotected 512-byte block being the only source of the data.
Yep.
And checksum, codes, et cetera, should be in the data block on the drive as per DVD encoding. And, of course, we're assuming a bit error rate of 10 to the 12th is the limit, isn't it? And then Alex is saying dead drives, by the way, are rare. They generally fall in well-understood ways, like I guess no trouble found is the most common. But, of course, from an application perspective, that's not always what initiates a rebuild. But his last point is bigger RAID groups reduce rebuild time on dead disks with parallelism. So some of the comments here about elongating the concept of RAID, and we talked about semantics, but now, Chris, you've sort of been trying to really, in your current role, you've written some algorithms around dispersal, looking at it in a different way. Can you talk a little bit about where dispersal fits in your view?
Yeah, so the way we define dispersal is it's a technique that includes not only erasure coding or Reed Solomon to give reliability, but also to encode the data to create other beneficial properties like security. So, you know, the idea of dispersal is, instead of storing data as the method of storing data, is to virtualize the data itself, to transform it into dispersed information as it's stored, and then to transform it back as it's read. And this is a technique that we currently do across servers, and it can be done, you know, the servers can be in different locations, but it could ultimately also be done, you know, within an array or even within a drive, you know, long term. So the idea is, if you have a piece of data to write, let's say it's an object that's, you know, a meg, instead of writing that object to a drive, or maybe breaking it up into pieces and putting, you know, different parts on a RAID array and then calculating a parity bit or two and put, you know, adding those as well, is you would transform that data into a lot of small elements. We call them slices of information. It's not segments of the data, but it's equations that can be used to rebuild the data later. And, you know, we're using both Reed Solomon and some security techniques, so that one property is what you're storing is a lot of little pieces. So you start off with a meg, let's say, object, and you would store up to 16 100K slices on different servers in such a way that you could tolerate the simultaneous loss of any six of them. So you could lose six servers, six drives, and if they're in different locations, you could lose six locations in such a way that you could, you know, in real time read the data back. So you're parallelizing the reads and the writes into smaller reads and writes on more servers, more drives, to improve performance. The slices are made in such a way that they're basically equations that by themselves are mathematically useless. So I can tolerate confidentiality loss of, you know, a multiple of them, multiple servers, multiple locations, without any loss in confidentiality. Plus, from a reliability point of view, you can tolerate the simultaneous failure of multiple things at once, a configurable number. So that's what dispersal is, and is capable of storing, you know, petabytes, exabytes of data with the properties of inherent reliability, you know, bit perfect data integrity, which we could talk about separately. But even if you have multiple simultaneous integrity failures, you know, the data is still delivered perfect in the same way it can recover from multiple simultaneous availability failures. So that's what dispersal is.
Okay, so are you proposing or projecting that dispersal is potentially a way to replace RAID or complement RAID? What's your scenario, Chris? How do you see that unfolding?
Well, the way we see dispersal starting off initially in larger deployments, so multi-petabyte, you know, to exabyte kind of scale deployments, where you have need for information security, high availability, high confidentiality, and or high data integrity. That's where dispersal really fits. It's not really focused on like database type applications. So that's where, you know, RAID is still a great performer. And even if you have to make multiple copies to solve these reliability problems, that's typically a pretty good trade-off for a transaction-oriented database, which tends to be a smaller data set. But when you're talking about, you know, large-scale applications like social networking applications, medical image storage, certain types of intelligence or government applications where it's, you know, tens of petabytes kind of data, you know, that's where dispersal is a fit. So I guess, you know, to answer your question directly, we see dispersal as a fit for those kinds of large-scale storage applications, but not currently a fit for transaction-oriented database applications where RAID still makes a lot of sense, and in some cases people are even using Flash or RAM for transaction-oriented databases.
Okay, and so part of that, if I understand it, is that the performance attributes of dispersal don't lend themselves to database, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's, you know, because you typically are deploying dispersal across a network, you have the latency of a network. And so if milliseconds, you know, are fine, then it can work. If microseconds are your issue, then you're not going to use any kind of network-based storage. So even though, you know, I guess I would say from a throughput point of view, dispersed systems can deliver extraordinarily high levels of throughput because there's no centralized anything. There's no cluster. There's no single, you know, read or write. You can configure them to have a million simultaneous readers and writers with, you know, millions of devices all engaging a lot of small, short, parallel conversation, you know, I/O. So you can get incredible throughput through those kinds of systems. What we don't recommend dispersal for is very low latency systems, you know, where, you know, at a minimum, you got to wait for a packet to come across a network. You know, in many cases, that's unacceptable. There may be in the future, and we would expect in the future, to see people employ this kind of dispersal technique, not just on network-based storage systems, but inside of an array, and maybe even, you know, ultimately to take the extreme. Like, you could do dispersed system over flash. If you had 10 petabytes of flash and you wanted to address, you know, perfect data integrity, you could do that. That's a little bit down the road, though. So we recommend dispersal for high throughput systems, but we don't recommend it for low latency systems.
Has anybody calculated the cost of 10 petabytes of flash?
No, I haven't, but I was curious regarding the bit error rate on flash technology. Where do you see that today?
From what we've seen, it's much higher than drives. And there's a lot of technique. I mean, it depends upon where you measure the bit error rate. If you're measuring it at the physical level versus, you know, a lot of flash systems have, you know, firmware or some other kind of system in front of it to kind of mask the real bit error rate to try to deliver high data integrity. But, you know, that's a question of, you know, where do you want to spend your money? Do you want, you know, in terms of, you know, hardware to solve that problem? But, you know, what flash is not non-volatile memory. It's just less volatile memory. So you're always going to have a relatively high bit error rate unless there's some kind of physical breakthrough, you know, in the flash system. But we've seen it's even, you know, drives are, you know, have lower bit error rates than flash typically.
Could I ask a question?
Go ahead.
And this was Klaus Mickelson.
Hey, Klaus.
Hey, how you guys doing? And by the way, I spoke on this subject at SNW and a couple of months ago, and had a fabulous side conversation with one of your folks, Chris, on this very same subject. So I'm glad to see you raise the red flag because I've been throwing it out there for years. But the one thing that hasn't really cropped into the discussion, I think, is an important one, is the cost. And you know, we all know that drives are getting denser and more capacious, but they're also getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And there's a bit of a trade-off between the cost of the media and also the cost of the environmentals. But as you start looking into the future, and we get to these 80, 20, and 40, and 50 terabyte drives, they're going to be pretty damn cheap when it comes to a cost per terabyte basis.
Yep.
So the concept of keeping, and by the way, when I talk about data dispersion, we do that at Hitachi more for a performance aspect than anything else. But as the cost gets cheaper, you can begin to replicate this more and more times. And that really seems like an opportunity, I think, from the technology. If, for example, you kept four copies of the data on four separate drives, not necessarily in a network environment, but within a single array.
Yep. Yeah, so just to talk about cost and replication, certainly there will be some applications where making four copies makes sense. But we've seen some markets like social networking. Those guys are so price sensitive. There's no way they're going to make four copies. So what they're looking for, and it's not just, you know, the cost of the drives. It's like four times as much electricity, four times as much data center space.
If somebody loses a tweet, that's not going to end the world. But if you start looking at the enterprise applications, the databases, the thing that really drives businesses worldwide, I think you can afford to keep multiple copies and reduce the risk of data loss.
Yeah. So let me just offer this as an alternative. So certainly four copies is one way to create reliability, and it has known pluses and minuses. A different way to create, if what four copies gives you is the ability to tolerate the simultaneous failure of three things, which is pretty good. Another way to do that, you know, is to, and if let's say those were four RAID copies, you'd also have the overhead of RAID. So you would be physically storing probably five to six times as many bits as you started with. Another way to do that would be to do something like, you know, an extreme example. Let's just say, you know, like a 10 of 16 with dispersal, where you're spreading 16 slices, which are each one-tenth the size of the original copy across 16 different servers, in such a manner that you could tolerate the simultaneous failure of any six of them. That would give you comparable reliability to four copies. But then when you add up the physical number of bits, with four copies, you're going to have, if they're RAID copies, you know, at least, let's say, 5 to 6x what you start with, so it's, you know, 400 to 500% overhead. With the 10 of 16 dispersal, you know, the slices are each one-tenth the size of the original. There's up to 16 of them, so at most you have 160%. So you'd have 60% overhead in your storage for comparable reliability versus, you know, 400 or 500%. So there will be many customers that will want to have, you know, that kind of increased efficiency in terms of electricity, floor space, power, you know, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah, I think I sort of categorize the world into two components. One is the old structured data that we sometimes tend to ignore, but really, like I said, runs applications worldwide, and then the unstructured content depots. And the impact of data loss between those two different worlds is entirely different. And you can tolerate data loss in one part of that world without serious disaster. In the other part of the world, you can't. So we may be talking about two different solutions here.
Right, and if you're dealing with multiple sort of RAID 1 copies, the rebuild time and the impact on performance during rebuild is substantially less. Isn't that correct, Klaus?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So back to one of the earlier comments, if I look holistically at a database application, transaction application, RAID 1 with multiple copies may continue to be the most cost-effective and reliable way to go forward for that type of data. For the rest of the data, which is where the bulk of the storage is, some other algorithm may be more appropriate.
That's my point. I think, I mean, even RAID 5 or RAID 6 in database applications, if the RAID is done at the right level, is acceptable in terms of performance. And, you know, the other part of this, and it gets into the cost, is what I call capacity efficiency. So we're seeing a lot more deduplication, compression, you know, different ways to get more out of the capacity. And so that sort of mitigates what you just said, Chris, in terms of the cost of additional copies of storage.
So for example, if you look at deduplication or compression, if that gave you, let's say, a 4x gain in efficiency, that would be pretty great, that's typical. You know, with dispersal, I think in the example I mentioned earlier, you would also have about a 4x gain in efficiency. So there's no reason, you know, so if you were to dedupe and then store the deduped data on a dispersed storage system, the realized efficiency would be the product, so it would be 4 times 4. So it would be 16 times more efficient. So that's, you know, so 4x efficient is great, but 4x squared is even better. So,
yeah.
You know, that's pretty compelling. And I agree with you that if in a database environment, absolutely, you know, most of the time, you know, replicated copies makes a lot of sense. But, you know, if you look at the number of bits that are in the world, you know, either on a, you know, looking at like an average hard drive, how many bits, what the bits are, or kind of coursing through the internet, the majority of bits now, since about, it was around 1999, are now unstructured content. And it's now about 65 to 70% of all bits are unstructured content. That's the area where I think dispersal really plays. We're not suggesting for structured content that's the right fit. But unstructured content is the largest amount of data, and it's the fastest. Oh. It's where all the growth of storage is.
No, absolutely no question about it. But that's also, I mean, you mentioned RAID M by N earlier. And that seems to be, in my mind, a reasonable approach for a lot of this unstructured data. It doesn't have the performance requirements necessarily that structured does. And, you know, if it takes a month or two to rebuild the drive and you've got three or four or five extra equivalent spares sitting out there, that's acceptable.
Yep, absolutely.
Your earlier point, Chris, of if I've compressed, if I've deduped, and if I've encrypted data and I lose a bit, the impact is substantially greater.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that always has to weigh in on this.
Yeah, with good encryption, if you lose a bit, the data should be gone. That's how encryption works. And that's also true of compression. The more efficient compression becomes, the less tolerant you are of bit loss. And,
right.
And what's happening is compression is also being driven by Moore's law because of the greater availability of massive amounts of processing. People get more and more sophisticated compression techniques, such as deduplication. And as they do that, which they will inevitably do because Moore's law is not going to stop, then the physical storage system or the application that's producing this highly compressed storage will become less and less tolerant to bit failure. I mean,
right.
If you don't use compression, bit failure is not a big deal, but you start really cranking up the compression, it starts getting more efficient, which of course it's going to, and then, certainly if you layer encryption on top of that, then individual bit failures become huge problems.
Can I ask a question going back to Flash? This is David Sawyer from Wikibon. Is there a model using dispersal with very large amounts of Flash as a front-end cache, which could give you near-equivalent performance? Is there a model that, in that way, that would bridge the gap?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that that's where all storage is heading, not just with dispersal. I mean, dispersal is really good for either large content or, like, back-end storage. And most of the time, what people do when they deploy dispersed systems is they do have some kind of front-end tier that sits in front of it. And that might be a tier that manages the database or the structured data. And then when you get to, let's say it's a database of video objects or medical images or something like that, that the bulk content would be well suited for a dispersed storage network, but the metadata is something that you would want to store locally. You probably might want to put that in Flash, maybe even RAM if there's not that much of it, so that you get wicked fast searches and all that kind of good stuff. And then when you're when you say, all right, I'm ready for the payload, it's a database of medical images, give me the X-ray, I've already kind of sorted through the patient information and all that stuff, all right, then go get that big object. And there your issue is not so much it's a 5 gig object. Well, time to first bit is not that relevant compared to how fast can I get the whole 5 gig object. So that's where dispersal is a great fit. And it also shows where traditional storage is a great fit for the database metadata part of that. And that's where Flash, I think, is often going to be used as a front-end cache.
Okay, other comments before we wrap? Any other? I want to make sure everybody has a chance to weigh in here.
Yeah, Dave, it's Rob Pegler. Just real quickly, again, very good discussion there. Appreciate the perspectives on that. It seems that, I've been listening to this, it seems that almost everybody has kind of given up in a way as to, thinking that the disk drive is actually a highly unreliable system. And, if you read the Gibson and Schrader paper, they say typically it exceeds 1%, 2 to 4% is common, and that's annual failure rates. Never mind the annual return rates for the no trouble phones, but I don't think we should tolerate 2% failure rates in disk drives. We certainly don't in CPUs or RAM or any other computer system. And we're seeing rates using drives in appropriate enclosures and intelligent elements of 0.02%. In other words, 100 times more reliable. That is a game changer in terms of how you architect storage. And believe me, it is certainly not 100x the cost to do that on a per-drive basis using firmware. It's just not. So I don't buy the notion that 2 to 4% is going to be an accepted thing in the world of storage in the long run. I don't at all. We need to make drives more reliable and treat them more reliably in groups and avoid what Gibson and Schrader correctly looked at in the field population of drives as they stand today of 2 to 4% annual failure rates being common. I, for one, as an engineer, I'm not going to tolerate that. Again, we don't in other components. Why do we do it in disk drives?
Great. Thank you, Rob. Other comments before we wrap? We've got about 2 minutes here. I just want to, again, make sure everybody who hasn't spoken has a chance. Please chime in. one of the areas that we have not talked about is big data. Klaus, you mentioned that, you know, it's not the end of the world when you lose a tweet. Well, it depends whose tweet it is, of course.
Yeah.
Tell that to Steve Foskett, who's left the call, we can say that. But in all seriousness, when you think about big data and information as the currency of the 21st century economy, and quant jocks sort of taking over and determining the direction of companies, that type of big, unstructured data becomes increasingly more important. The interesting thing about RAID is for years, it hit that perfect match of, and Brett Cooper touched on a couple of these legs. He talked about reliability and performance, and of course, RAID helped with the capacity at the right cost. It had that sort of perfect mixture to handle these different data types, and obviously was very successful. And it's so we've been discussing ways to extend that notion of balance between cost and capacity and performance. And we've talked about N by N. We've talked about better drive reliability, new grouping methods. Dispersal is sort of this new emerging approach, which, of course, Google uses in a form. Right, Chris? Is that a fair thing to say, right?
Kind of. I wouldn't say exactly that. But
okay.
So, we've got time to go into that.
Yeah, okay. So another peer insight. But this notion of big data increasing the importance of unstructured, the value of unstructured data, and bringing that notion of the code to the data is sort of a new way to think about this. And at the same time, again, we've talked about extending the notion of RAID. So, Chris Gladwin, I'll give you the last word. Any closing thoughts?
Thanks. I would appreciate all the comments. Great discussion. I guess the final way I would look at it is, we've seen a huge trend on the compute side to virtualize computing, and the whole industry is moving toward cloud computing as a result, and the huge efficiencies that go with it. And that's because the compute has been virtualized. In order to really move the industry forward on the storage side, we now need to think about virtualizing storage itself and getting those same kind of benefits of flexibility and efficiency and, you know, management capability that the cloud computing guys are bringing to kind of virtualizing storage. And I think that's the big trend that's about to begin.
Excellent. Well, on behalf of the Wikibon community, Chris Gladwin, I'd really like to thank you for joining the call today. I appreciate your insights.
Well, thank you. We really enjoyed it.
And also the other Wikibon folks and members and participants on the call today, Aviato from IBM, I apologize if I've butchered your name, Brett Cooper as well, Josh Krischer, always a pleasure to hear from you, Alex Tangent on Justin as well, Dennis Martin, Steve Foskett, thank you for your comments, and Rob Pegler, thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate it. Klaus, you helped start this whole thing with your SNW talk, so thanks for bringing it up and giving a great talk at SNW, and keep up the good work. And David Floyer, and also on Justin Floriscan. So thanks, everybody. And as a reminder, over the next 24 hours or so, we'll have up 6 research notes on this call, summarizing the call and talking about specific user actions. And so feel free to hit the edit tab and improve the pieces, or write your own piece, or put up a wiki tip. And we really appreciate your time today. And thanks for listening, everybody. And thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.